This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Richard Sloan is troubled by the growing belief among Americans that worship and prayer can help prevent or cure disease, or in some cases even substitute for traditional medical treatment. Sloan acknowledges the comfort religion brings to many people in times of difficulty, but he questions studies purporting to show that distant prayers help cure illness or that regular attendance at religious services promotes health. Sloan is particularly skeptical of physicians who believe medical exams should include a spiritual history of their patients' lives. Richard Sloan is a professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University. His new book is called Blind Faith: The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. One of the points you make in the book is that typically when one investigates the efficacy of medical treatments, you do clinical studies in which there are in which both the recipients of the treatment as well as those who are giving it don't even know in some cases who's getting the placebo and who is getting the actual treatment. That's why they're called double blind. It's very hard to do that in a lot of the questions involving faith in medicine, right? Why?
It's impossible with one exception. The problem is that in the conventional randomized clinical trial, both the investigator controls administration of the treatment agent under evaluation. And so some patients with the medical condition receive the treatment, others don't receive the treatment. Nobody knows, neither the investigators nor the patients know whether they're receiving it or not. And then you measure the outcomes. The problem with studies of religion and health, by and large, is that you can't control assignment to being religious or not religious. You can't make a group of patients religious, half of them religious and half of them not religious, and then follow them for 10 years and see whether the ones who were made religious do better than the ones who don't. And so in the absence of that ability to control, all you can do is look at people who differ in the index of interest, religiosity, for example, self-reported church attendance, reading the Bible. You look at those who vary in this dimension and then see whether they perform differently, whether they do differently, whether they survive longer or whether they develop less heart disease, or if they have heart disease, develop fewer complications. The problem is that those people are self-selected. The people who are religious differ in many other respects beside their religiosity from those who are not religious. And it's extraordinarily difficult to tease apart which factors may contribute to the difference in the outcomes as a result of that kind of self-selection.
You often read or hear people say that there are a number of studies that show that regular attendance at religious services is associated with better health. And you look in particularly at one of them that's better known. It's based on interviews of almost 100,000 people from Washington County, Maryland, which concluded that regular attendance at religious services was associated with longer lives and better health. What did you find inadequate about that study?
This study provides the classic example of the failure, initially at least, to recognize that another factor may be responsible for the outcome variable. You're right, 100,000 or so residents of Washington County, Maryland were surveyed in the 60s, and then in the early 70s they were examined to see how many of them were still alive, and the reports indicated that those who in the 1960s reported that they attended church services more frequently were more likely to survive than those who reported that they attended church services less frequently. Several years later, the lead author of this study published another report essentially retracting these findings, suggesting that he failed to consider a critically important factor, which we refer to as functional status, which means how sick people are to begin with. Those people who in the 60s were initially functionally disabled, where they were sicker than the others, were the ones who were less likely to go to church. And they were also, of course, more likely to die. So rather than having a religious factor contribute to a survival difference or a health outcome, it was that a health outcome was influencing the capacity to go to church. Those people who were too sick couldn't get to church, and they were the ones who were more likely to die.
One of the points you make is that those who advocate religion as a means of achieving better health overstate the number of studies which tend to positively associate religion and health.
Yes, there's quite a gross overstatement of the number of studies. Some reports say there are 1,200 studies. Others say 800, 900. It depends upon when you read the reports. Yes, in fact, there are a great number of studies that are about religion and health, but a far smaller fraction of those are actually about the benefits of religious devotion for health. There were comparisons of denominational differences, Jews versus Christians, Catholics versus Protestants. Others were about health fairs in religious settings. Others were about the impact of religion on medical decision-making. Still others were about religious devotion, religious involvement as an outcome variable. For example, when some people become catastrophically ill, their religious beliefs may change. They may become more devout. They may become less devout. None of those other studies is really related to the issue of the benefits of religious devotion for health.
Now, there, of course, are some that do directly attempt to answer that. Those questions related to that. And one of them that you talk about is a fairly well-known study at the Pacific Medical Center in California of 40 AIDS patients. And this was interesting. They randomly assigned half of the patients to receive assistance from distant healers, people who were off-site, didn't know these people, but they were rabbis, Native American spiritualists, psychics, and they did whatever they thought would be helpful for this person to promote their healing. And then the study found that at the end of it, those who had received the benefits or the attempted benefits of the distant healers did better, at least as measured by fewer AIDS-related illnesses and shorter hospitalizations. Now, is that evidence convincing?
No. We have a paper that's just recently published examining the methods of in these studies, and there are some fundamental problems with studying the effects of distant intercessory prayer. Now, we talked about the problem before about in most studies of religion and health, you can't take a group of people and make half of them religious and half not, and so you have to rely on pre-existing differences. The one area in this field where you actually can conduct a randomized clinical trial is these studies of distant intercessory prayer, because you can assign at random some people to receive the prayers of the intercessors and others not. And on the surface, that appears persuasive. You can actually control the exposure to prayer. But in fact, you can't control the exposure to prayer. You can only control the exposure to the prayer of the intercessors that you select. But you don't control the prayer from friends, family, other relatives, co-workers, community members, members of the religious congregation, members of congregations from around the world who pray for all the sick all the time. And so in the absence
meaning that some in the control group may have been receiving intercessory prayers that you don't measure?
A great many in the control group are undoubtedly receiving the prayers from others, and we have no idea how many prayers they receive and how many prayers those in the experimental group receive. And in the absence of that knowledge, we can never draw any conclusions about whether these studies can be effective or not. So that's one fundamental problem. Another fundamental problem in these studies, in these intercessory prayer studies, and in the other studies and more generally, is the failure of the scientists to make specific predictions about what the outcome variables are. In these studies of intercessory prayer, far too often, the experimenters examine dozens of outcome variables, most of which are never significant, and then only one or two turn out to be significant, and they say, aha, there it is. And this is a significant methodological failure best described by what physicist Robert Park refers to as the sharpshooter's fallacy. The sharpshooter's fallacy is that the sharpshooter empties the six gun into the side of the barn and then draws the bullseye. That's a fundamental violation of scientific methods. You have to specify in advance what your hypothesis is, what variable you're going to test, and then you test it. And if it works, good. And if it doesn't, well, too bad.
Our guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. His new book is called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. He has written a book called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. You know, one of the studies that you write about is called the Mantra 2 studies, and I forget what the acronym for Mantra is, but this was aimed at looking at the benefits of various spiritual activities on people's health. And this study concluded that intercessory prayer had no effect. And yet you write that as it got reported in the media, it seemed almost as if the opposite conclusion were drawn.
The problem is this is a problem that occurs widely in science, that research reports sometimes appear in the press long before they appear in the scientific literature. To appear in the scientific literature requires that that the paper go through peer review, and sometimes that takes a long time. Sometimes the paper is rejected by one journal and goes for review by another, et cetera. And eventually it appears. But before that, a discussion of it may take place in the media, and the media coverage of the MANTRA study suggested that, in fact, there were effects of the distant intercessory prayer, when, in fact, when the report finally emerged in the scientific literature, it was clear that there weren't.
One of the interesting things I found about that MANTRA 2 study was that while it debunked the idea that distant intercessory prayer had had an effect on health, it did find that those patients who received what was described as music-guided imagery and touch therapy did seem to do better. I mean, does that tell us something about spirituality and health?
I don't think it tells us anything about spirituality and health. It tells the interesting thing about that finding is that you're talking about an intervention there at the bedside, in which somebody comes in and interacts with the patients, in contrast to the distant prayer where there are intercessors at some great distance away from the patients. So there may be something about engaging in some supportive interaction with patients prior to and immediately following a medical procedure that may have an outcome. And that's probably worth exploring. And, of course, some people do explore that. The problem with the MANTRA study is the discussion of the findings almost exclusively revolved around the intercessory prayer outcomes and not these other outcomes.
My guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. He's written a new book called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. You know, apart from looking at the data and the scientific methodology in claims of the benefits of religion and health, I think a lot of people think it makes intuitive sense, at least parts of it. I mean, the notion that people who attend a religious service regularly have an hour or two a week where they sit and engage in a quiet, contemplative activity surrounded by a supportive community, and that can only be good for your mental health. It can only reduce stress. Doesn't that make sense in a way?
Well, it does make sense, but the people attend religious services for a great many reasons. Garrison Keillor is reported to have said that anyone who believes that sitting in church makes you a Christian must also believe that sitting in a garage makes you a car. people go to church for any number of reasons, social reasons, out of loneliness, out of habit, to make business connections. Religious devotion is certainly one of them, but it's attending church is a complex phenomenon. Nobody disputes that religion provides comfort to people in times of difficulty, whether it's illness-related or otherwise. That's not in dispute. The question is whether medicine can add anything to that, and I think the answer is no. People ought to be entirely free to practice their religion in any way they see fit in medical contexts. And physicians need to know about that, but physicians shouldn't use that information to base interventions on.
Some would say you shouldn't proselytize religion, you shouldn't advocate a faith, but that you do your patients a favor by suggesting that they focus on positive spirituality, you know, things that we all agree would be good, you know, honesty, self-control, joy, love, hope, generosity. What about that school of thought?
Well, you know, that's wonderful advice. Our mothers all gave us that advice. The problem is we don't have any idea whether that's related to health. We don't know whether people who are joyful and honest live longer than people who are cynical and dishonest. We just have no idea. It doesn't seem to me that that's the business of a physician to be making those kinds of moral judgments. That is the legitimate business of the clergy to make those kinds of recommendations, but not physicians.
Do you think there's a concern that if someone tends to look at their physical health and what's happening in their physical life as a consequence of their relationship with God, that they will, in effect, blame themselves for an illness?
That's clearly the case. if you blame yourself as a result of some failure, then you may increase the risk of becoming sick. Certainly, you increase the distress that you experience in a way that's not conducive to better health. Let me give you an example of that's related to this, one of the significant ethical issues associated with attempts to connect religion and health, the possibility that you can actually cause harm. About my first foray into this field of religion and health was more than 20 years ago when I was interviewing young women who were about to receive the results of gynecologic biopsies to determine whether or not they had cervical cancer. And I was interviewing a woman in a semi-private room. She was separated by a thin curtain from the other patient, also awaiting the results of her biopsy. And this other patient had her family with her. And while I was interviewing my patient, the biopsy results for the other patient came back, and they were negative. And her father exclaimed to nobody in particular, "We're good people. We deserve this." Now, that's a perfectly reasonable thing for the father of a potentially sick young woman to say. Perfectly reasonable. But what was the young woman I was interviewing supposed to say to herself when her biopsy came back positive? Was she supposed to say, "I'm a bad person. That's why I got sick. I've been insufficiently devout. That's why I got cancer"? It's bad enough to be sick. It's worse still to be gravely ill. But to add to that the burden of guilt or remorse over some supposed failure of devotion is simply unconscionable. But that's precisely what you get when you make assertions about the health benefits of religious devotion. If you suggest that religious devotion is good for your health, then you automatically imply that poor health may be associated with insufficient devotion. And that's simply unconscionable.
You know, in the interest of giving voice to a different perspective here, you know, there's a lot in the physical world that would seem like magic. I mean, the fact that when I'm on the beach, that the waves, ocean waves, come higher because of the gravity of the moon is, in some respects, just seems ridiculous. And the very idea of, take radio waves. I mean, the fact that your voice and mine is being carried in these invisible transmissions that penetrates people's bodies and their pets, but then a receiver can translate into sounds, would have seemed magical and absurd a couple of centuries ago. What about those who say that what's happening with prayer and spiritual activity may represent a level of science we just don't understand yet?
Well, it's certainly true that science progresses by new discoveries that may contradict the prevailing view. And we've seen that throughout the history of science. The view of the universe, the view of the position of Earth relative to the other planets in the solar system, beginning of the Christian era, the Greek view, the Ptolemaic view, was that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that was superseded by the Copernican view that the Earth revolves around the sun. We've seen revolutions take place throughout science. The problem is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And the claims about the effects of distant intercessory prayer are quite extraordinary, but the evidence is far from extraordinary. And there is nothing that we know about the physical universe that can possibly account for how the prayers or healing intentions of someone in Baltimore can influence the course of patients in a coronary care unit in Los Angeles. There's just nothing we know about the universe that can account for that. Now, that's not to say that at some point we may not discover that there is something. We certainly will discover other things about the universe, but these kinds of extraordinary claims require absolutely extraordinary evidence, and the evidence is far, far from extraordinary.
Richard Sloan, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Richard Sloan is a professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University. His new book is Blind Faith: The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine.